Welcome back to Elevation Trail with me, Tim Long, and Gary David. How are you doing today, Gary?
I've been really, really, really busy. Really busy getting my syllabi together for the two courses I'm teaching, which start next week. Going back to school, got to get the syllabi done so the students don't have any recourse later on the semester when they come to me and say, "You didn't tell me I had to do that," when I give them a bad grade for something they didn't do. And this is not hypothetical. There was an example. This is probably the best example I can think of. Many years ago, I had a student who didn't show up for like the second half of the semester. Didn't show up, right? Why show up to a class? And then when he got a bad grade, he said to me, "You didn't say in the syllabus that you had to show up to class." And so, right? I mean, so, you know, this guy probably went on to become a very, you know, a successful attorney. The point being, when I first started teaching, the first class I ever taught in my life was back in 1993. When I first started teaching, my syllabus was 2 pages long, literally 2 pages long. The syllabus now has gone to about maybe 9 pages long because it's almost like a contract. You start to feel the need to stipulate every single potential rule that or evaluation point that a student must adhere to, where you think things should be taken for granted. Like I was just talking to a student and I said, "You needed to cite more materials in the paper." And she said, "Oh, I thought I just had to read them and not cite them, because I didn't say after you read something, you're supposed to work it into your research paper," which I thought was taken for granted. Apparently not. So as you come up with these examples throughout your life, your syllabus gets longer. It becomes like contract law. So the whole point is to make sure students are not able to weasel out of anything where they don't want to do work because they come to you and say, "Well, you didn't say it in the syllabus." So that's what I've been doing, going through and making my contract. And actually, some professors have students sign their syllabi now, sign their syllabus and turn it back in as if it was a contract. Now, I don't know. We're about the same age. I don't recall doing that when I was an undergraduate. Do you?
No.
And so this is where we are, people. We have students signing contracts in class that indemnifies us and them regarding the expectations of what is appropriate behavior during the course of the semester. So this is what I'm dealing with right now.
Fun.
How are you?
Good, good. I've been spending lots of quality time out in the local trails here in the high desert near Grand Junction in the Grand Valley.
Doing what?
Course marking. We got the Grand Junction Off-Road, which is put on by Epic Rides, coming up this this weekend. The 15-mile, I believe, is Friday, and then the 30 and 40-mile is Saturday. So everybody's scampering around trying to get ready for that, and I am the course coordinator for the event, so I get to put out 550 of these, like, I don't know, 3-foot-long metal flags, which is a joy carrying. So yesterday I was out marking the most remote part of the course, way out. It's called Third Flats and Windmill Road. I use the term road loosely, but anyway, it's right, like 4x4 Jeep trails. And so I'm out there carrying like 100 of these metal flags, and a lightning and thunderstorm comes ripping then over the National Monument. And I'm at like the highest point of the course, which is like 6,700 feet, with these metal flags standing there. 11 miles into my run that, you know, marking. And so, yeah, I had to dump the flags and go hide somewhere for a few minutes until the storm passed over. That was a highlight.
Of course, it raises the question of why bother marking a course.
I know.
Right?
Yeah, and, you know, it's important. I mean, you would think like 550 flags for 40 miles of or 45 miles of courses. I mean, that
seems excessive.
It's a lot, but especially mountain biking, you know, you want to make sure that people stay on course. There's quite a bit of money involved. I think that's $20,000 prize purse for the 40-mile race. A little bit more than your midnight ride race, I think, in terms of prize money.
A little bit more.
You're giving away soap, right?
We do have samples of Dr. Bronner's hemp soap because we have 500 little bars. Dr. Bronner's is great, by the way. Great company.
Yeah.
I just emailed them a cold email, and they were like, "Yeah, we're on board. Can we send you a soap?" So I have 500 bars of Dr. Bronner's soap, and Dr. Bronner's is all about sustainability and all about social justice and corporate ethics, and so we like those things, and so I'm very proud to have my 500 bars of Dr. Bronner's soap, for
sure. Yeah, no, I use that for backpacking all the time, a little liquid soap, but so anyway, yeah, it is, it's excessive, it seems like, putting out all these flags, but it's important, so they don't get lost, don't go off course, you know, the last thing you want is to have some guy come across the line and looking for his 10 grand or whatever he ends up winning and have someone, you know, notice that he didn't follow the correct course that everybody else did. But there are, there's going to be, I think, officials.
That would never happen.
No, no.
Seriously?
Yeah. But yeah, so that brings us to a couple of things that have been going on recently. It seems like just like when you buy a car, you know, like say you buy like a white VW Bug, and all of a sudden you start noticing there's a bunch of VW Bugs all over the place, and you never noticed them before. But it seems like there's a lot of like these instances coming up where people are either intentionally or unintentionally not following certain rules or implied rules. They may not even be official rules. And just like you were saying, it's just shouldn't it be accepted or understood that certain things are supposed to happen the way they do? And sometimes we can't take that for granted that everybody agrees on things.
And we had last week, we had Mike Aish on the show, which was fortuitous because Mike is a great guy and he actually sent me a t-shirt with some stickers, so that was awesome. but also the whole issue about Rob Carrar not running the accurate course at Leadville. And and the idea of whether or not Rob should be disqualified from that race because of his violation of the rules. And Leadville, finally, on August 22nd, came out with a ruling. Shall I read the ruling?
Yes.
Please. Okay.
Thanks.
Upon review, the event management team has determined that the announced 2014 Leadville Trail 100 winner, Rob Carrar, encountered inadequate race course markings during his outbound travels to the Winfield Aid Station. Carrar chose the more defined Continental Divide Trail, which sent him on a longer course into Winfield, adding more than 1 mile of distance, along with significant elevation gain. As such, this course deviation did not provide Carrar with any advantage whatsoever in completing the event relative to other competitors. Therefore, the race result stands, and we congratulate Rob Carrar for his impressive victory. Josh, can I say Colley or Coley? Josh Colley.
Colley, yeah.
Josh Colley, LRS race director.
Yeah, so good. First of all, good for them for, you know, coming out at least the, like last year when people were upset. Some people were upset about the way the race was handled. There was like, you know, no mention whatsoever from the race officials or the organizers for months and months and months. They just ignored it, and that left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And so good for them for coming out and at least making an announcement to shut everybody up about this thing.
And totally their call, because they are, there is no separate agency or institution or organization that is overseeing adherence to the rules. It's Leadville's race.
Yep.
They're the ones who make determinations regarding whether or not someone violated the rules or whether there were extenuating circumstances that contributed to the violation of those rules and whether or not the violation of those rules contributed to an unfair advantage given to that competitor. Yeah. Totally within their prerogative.
Yep, it is. And I mean, which brings up a whole nother, you know, avenue for questions like, you know, are they adequate people to be officiating a race like this? Do they want to impose, you know, their own rules? Do they need to, you know, revamp the whole structure of the rules and make them more clear? And frankly, you know, like when I used to put on races, I would just get most of my events sanctioned by the USATF. That way, there's specific rules that everybody has to follow. There's no question about it. Everybody can, you know, knows ahead of time what the expectations are. So anyway, and it's, you know, obviously we don't want to make any more of a big deal of it than it already has been. The case, it's over, it's done. Rob won, you know, fair and square in terms of Lifetime Fitness's, you know, statement. However, you know,
yes,
my buddy and a guy that we had on the show a few weeks ago, Brandon Fuller wrote a little blog post about it, and some people got bent out of shape about it, and all he was doing was saying, what's up? Should Rob Carr be disqualified? He did not run the same course, the official race course. Period.
Right.
There's no question that he did not run that course. It's not hearsay. It's known.
He admitted to it. Rob admitted to it.
Admitted to it. And, you have the Strava, which, the Strava, even though it's not 100% accurate in terms of mileage and things like that, you can obviously see that he ran a different course. But anyway, so Brandon brought it up, and people commented. Now there's 84 comments on his blog post,
right.
And he took a pretty hard beating. And he's seeing how what it's like, kind of putting on elevation trail, basically.
Mm.
At sometimes, and he took some heat for it. When all he was doing was just asking, hey, if our sport wants to be taken seriously, shouldn't we, follow rules more closely, or at least have some, and that's something that we've argued for 3 years now,
Yep. And I want to compare this to the three strikes and your outlaw, because there's obvious comparisons between this, Rob Carr, and having three felony convictions.
Obvious. Can you point those out to us?
To me, it's obvious, because one of the issues with three strikes and you're out, which is in certain states, if you're convicted of any three felonies, by the time you get to the third felony, I believe it's, life in prison without parole. I could be wrong on that final point. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have all the jurisdictions in the top of my head in terms of what their laws are. But three strikes and you're out. And the reason why judges hate that is because it removes any ability to give a sentence based upon the facts, the material facts of the case. There's no judgment of the judge, him or herself, that will influence the sentence. It's all, mandatory minimums. It's all, you
black.
Have to follow this rule, black and white.
Black and white, yeah.
The problem here becomes things like this, right? So you get a situation, let's say someone has two DUIs, right, and then a possession of marijuana. Three felonies. Is that a person you want to have in in a federal prison, but in a, in a prison for life or for whatever, for an extended period of time? Is that do you want to spend money, tax money? Do you want to take time in the criminal justice system dealing with that person in that way? And my point is, do you want to have a hard and fast following of the rule as the rule is written without any kind of judgment made by the officials, or do you want to have that wiggle room in there?
Mm-hmm.
And this, I'm not giving an answer for this because I don't know if there is an answer, but that is why it reminds me of three strikes and you're out. So at the time when everyone was saying, we got to get a hard on crime, we need to have mandatory minimums, three strikes and you're out. Yeah, three strikes and you're out. Then you get that, and what happens? You get people in prison taking up prison cells, clogging up the system, costing a lot of money, who are not violent offenders.
Yeah, shoplifted a sweater from Sears or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why it kind of makes me think about those kinds of things as well. And, it's hard to provide a complete rule that, if you say you have to enter into the course where you left, okay, what's that mean? Do you have to specify GPS coordinates for the exact point?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I know I'm being silly here, but it can become kind of a silly exercise in what is the rule and what does the rule mean, and we have to follow it exactly as it's written.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the whole feeling of ultras. If you ask a lot of people why they get into them, it's because of the quote-unquote freedom of it, I guess, and the escape,
right,
and all this. And it's a much looser environment, I think, than like track racing or road racing and marathons and stuff like that. That's attractive to people, but it also, at a certain level, it decreases the value, I think, of the sport in general too. It's difficult as a fan to follow the sport if there are no rules. Is this the Leadville Fun Run now?
And I'm glad you mentioned track racing. If I may provide case number two. Okay,
yep.
If we can move on to case number two, because we actually have a guest coming on. Well, we actually guests are pre-recorded, and I know we want to get to. Case number two, speaking of track racing and ultra running, is the 6 days in the dome Ultra that took place in Alaska, which involved running around a quarter mile track or so for 6 days. Yes, this was put on by Joe Fayas, who is a very accomplished ultra runner, been on the U.S. national team, world's team, and he put the race on and also took took part in it.
And he won it.
He won the thing. He won the thing. He was a little bit disappointed in that he was shooting for 600 miles, which would be, if you can do the math for a 6 day race, 100 miles a day. He only got up to, let me see, he got up to 580.56 miles in 6 days.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and but not without controversy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm reading here from the Alaska Dispatch News, okay, and this is a quote from this story. His number one competitor was a guy named David Johnson, and it says, through 4-plus days, Fayas's closest competition was David Johnson, 44 of Willow. I guess that's Willow, Alaska. After 96 hours, 4.5 days, Johnston trailed Fayas by about 20 miles, 447.95 to 427.13. So this was a barn burner, neck and neck. That was roughly when Johnson pulled out of the event late Friday night. He said he believed Fayas was being paced by other runners. A note on the race's website said pacing was prohibited, but that note did not define what constitutes pacing. Fayas said he sometimes ran in a train, quote-unquote, of runners. A train is a group of racers running close together, single file. Fayas says trains are common in ultramarathons. He does not consider that being pace.
Yeah.
And then Johnson said he definitely considered a train to be pacing. So on the ultra listserv, it blew up with people talking about whether or not it was pacing. And actually, Gary Cantrell, a.k.a. Lazarus Lake, also known as a guy who was on our podcast for being the race director of Barkley Marathons, he was there kind of live tweeting or live emailing the event. And I don't know how you run 6 days on a track without running with other people.
Yeah.
It seems near impossible. However, there was concern that he was, in fact, being paced by other runners. Fayas said people were running with him, but not pacing him. That they latched onto him, but they were not helping him.
Mm-hmm.
And I should also mention at the same website, I'm noticing in this picture of Joe running, he's also wearing earphones, which is in direct violation of USATF rules of running a race. They're pounding on my desk. So he's not only violated potentially the pacing rule, he also was wearing headphones, and for that he absolutely should be disqualified. So here we go again, right? What's the rule?
Yeah, well, it's just kind of a, you know, like I said, a backwoods redneck sport. There are none, really. People do whatever they want and appear to get away with it. It's fine, right?
But this was on a track. I mean, I know Alaska is backwoods. In the most beautiful kind of way, so don't send emails about Alaska being wonderful. We all know it's wonderful. We see the TV shows on about Alaska wilderness all the time. The fact that this was actually a sanctioned race in which records could be posted and were for women's 48-hour record, Joe's record. So records were posted. There was official stuff going on here. They had the precise measurements of the track made. Efforts were made to make sure things were quote-unquote done right. And then we have this thing. Were people running together officially pacing? And by the way, one of the reasons why women start earlier than men in marathons and road marathons is you would have very fast men pacing the elite women. If you could run a 220 as a guy, you can pace the elite women, right? You aren't going to be anywhere near the money in the men's race, but you're good enough to pace women and possibly be paid to do that. So they started that rule. So is this pacing or not? I don't know. It turned out that on the listserv again that Andy Milroy, very accomplished ultramarathoner, gave rules from the IAAF, not USATF. So another governing body saying that what happened there did not constitute official pacing because of the fact that people were competing, that they had started when they started, that they had not left the track and finished and quit and then come back on the track. So all these reasons, this was not pacing as defined by the IAAF, even though it might be considered pacing by the USATF. I'm not sure. But then when we talk about rules, whose rules are we supposed to follow? Yeah. I'm confused.
Yeah.
Are you confused?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, always.
Now, what do you think? I mean, you know, you're a race director, or were in a former life. You've not run six-day races on tracks, but what do you make of this? Is this all due by nothing, or is this a violation of the rules?
Yeah, as you were pointing out in the beginning of the show about having to put together syllabus and syllabi for your students, yeah. In order for the – so there's, you know – an expectation set, and there's no, well, I didn't know that. You know, it's like, you know, we, like you and I talked about right off the bat when we read about Rob going off course at Leadville, and not knowing something is not, you know, going to expunge you from, you know, being held accountable.
Expunge, I like that. That's good. Expunge.
Yeah. So anyway, so I mean, it's like speeding. You know, you can't tell the cop. Well, I had no idea it was 25 miles an hour in that zone, and I was doing 45. You know, that's no excuse. But you know, I think it's important to have those, you know, rules in place in the beginning, so there aren't any questions. And if you look at Leadville's site, it says that runners must follow the marked course, and in bold cap letters, it says stay on the trail. I think something like that. But, you know, anyway, I mean, a lot of people arguing, well, he ran a more difficult route and ran a little bit extra mileage, so, it, you know, it doesn't matter. He still is the winner, but whatever. I mean, we'll move on from that. But
and, you know, of course, in triathlon, there are defined rules as to how far behind on the bike you can be from someone until it's considered to be drafting. I've always found it odd that you can't draft on the bike, but you can draft in the swim and on the run. But, you know, do you want to go into a situation like with a six-day deal to say, okay, you have to be 3 meters behind, right? Hmm. That, you know, and we're going to have officials out there in every turn for 6 days to make sure that you have three, you know, it's like you went to Catholic school at the dances in eighth grade, you know, make room for Jesus, right? In between, you have to have a certain amount of distance in between you in order for it to be considered official. And is that the route people want to go to say that's the rule? Now it's unambiguous, clear cut, very easily defined. And isn't the whole point of this, by the way, when people like people do this, is that they can run together and talk with one another and be social?
Yeah. Yeah, and on a side note, I've always felt that I'd like to see drafting actually in triathlon. I think it'd make it kind of cool.
I think so too. The only problem with that is the insurance, because triathletes can't ride bikes. Another podcast for another time. Yeah, I said it. Send the emails in, and I have videotape I've seen on YouTube of that being proven. So
I've ridden with tri guys in groups, and I can attest to their inadequacy on the bikes.
I knew a triathlete once who crashed on his trainer. I'm not even making that up. Just damn fell over on the trainer in the basement, fell over, and that was probably the ultimate triathlon move, was crashing on your trainer.
Sweet. Was he wearing a skin suit?
You know what? I think he probably was.
Mm. Other things that, you know, as we started digging through, you know, I don't want the whole realm of like not following rules, whether it's intentional or unintentional, bringing up cheating and things like that. There's been a lot of news out there. I mean, that there was a woman who was Joe, who puts on the Rocky Raccoon 100, disqualified a woman for cutting the course, and it was pretty obvious when you look at her, because the Rocky Raccoon is, I think, 5 laps of 20 miles each, and you look at one of her like middle laps or something, and it was just crazy fast. So it was kind of obvious that she cut the course on that, unless she rode a bike.
Which would be against the rules.
Should be, yeah.
Does it say it in the rules?
Probably. I think, because Joe, I think almost all of his races are USATF sanctioned.
Ah.
Yeah. So he, like you brought up, it's difficult for a race director to be put in that position of an official. They're not trained for it. they probably don't know all the official rules of, you know, whatever governing bodies there are. And it's tough. It's a tough position to be in when everybody's looking at you to come up with the answer and you don't have the training to give a solid answer, I guess. But there's that, and then obviously the, you know, the big story of Kip Litton, another Michiganian.
Is it Michigander or Michiganian?
I never liked Michigander because I always thought of ducks. Michiganian.
I'll go with that.
One that I always liked. So yeah, and he, you know, obviously is a big marathon cheater. Why do people do this? You know, obviously Rob, it was a complete mistake, and he had no intention, obviously, of cheating.
Right.
I mean, he's an amazing runner. And,
he's Canadian.
He's Canadian. Canadians don't so lie, and
they don't cheat.
He's a great guy. We had him on the show actually before, and you know, so there's that.
He's aspect. A pharmacist. They don't cheat
exactly. So, and then there's, you know, going out of your way to cheat, i.e., like Lance Armstrong. You know, it's kind of weird. I don't understand why people do it. I mean, I remember the first time that I ever personally encountered somebody cheating in a race. Was this like Hokie 5K in Charlotte, North Carolina? And it's back, well, I don't know, a few years ago when I could run like a 17:30 5K, you know, which for me, it's I saw my grandmother right now to run a 17:30. But anyway, that put me in a pretty decent position to be okay, you know, and especially in some, you know, I don't know, small 5K race. And there's right. this guy who's about my age, in my age group, who is running with me, and he cuts across the corner of someone's lawn on a,
right.
on a turn. And it's like, why do that?
Right.
You know, one, I see you doing it.
Right.
And secondly, what are you gaining? I mean, do you you may cross the finish line in front of me and get the little cute medal that's a different color than mine. But other than that, I mean, how do you like – what do you think about when you're like lying in bed that night? Like, you know, congratulations to me for running 3.106 instead of 0.685, you know, in miles. And it's like, I don't understand the point of it. There's no money or anything.
Well, that reminds me actually when I was in Memphis, Tennessee for work years ago. This was before my teaching gig. I was there at the same time as a Memphis Marathon. I wasn't running it. I knew some people who were running it, so I was watching it. And towards the finish line, I saw this elite masters guy. There was a blue line basically that you're supposed to follow. That marks the course. So sometimes on some of the major marathons, you'll see a line that marks the official distance, and you're not supposed to deviate too much from that line. It's the shortest distance basically. And this guy jumped a curb, right, mm-hmm. and ran across the curb, clearly cutting part of the course. I mean, it wasn't a huge part, but if we're talking about following the rules again, right, how much of an infraction does one have to make to constitute a reportable infraction? And it kind of goes to if you're driving 60 in a 55, you're technically speeding. It's a violation of the law, but you're probably not going to be stopped. And so then you have people who intentionally push the limits of the rules without necessarily trying to violate the spirit of the rule. You know what I mean? So again, it's one of those things where you go, I don't know how I feel about that. It feels wrong, but is it enough to be reportable to somebody else? Hmm. And again, if you report it to a race director, what's the race director going to do without any visual evidence? And so it comes down to what's evidence, right? No one saw this woman cheat. All they're going by are her results. And oh, by the way, if you go to Ultra sign up right now and look for her results, you know what you find?
Nothing.
Nothing. She's a non-person in Ultra sign up now.
Yeah.
No results.
Mark Gilligan, the owner of Ultra sign up, stripped her of all her results on his site. Also, this lady that was disqualified from the Rocky Raccoon 100 for her cheating. And it brings up another good point, too, is you better be damn sure that the person cheated if you're going to make it public.
You better be damn sure, and you better be sure that I would say it was intentional in terms of how you frame the allegation. Exactly what your dog said. In terms of how you frame the allegation, you better make sure that the person did it and did it with intent. Otherwise, you're going to incur the wrath of a whole lot of people who are in the ultra community or the running community or the biking community online, because that's where a lot of these things are happening right now, is online. People are airing their grievances and their accusations on Twitter, Facebook, blogs, etc., and that's where a lot of these comments are being generated and taking place.
Yeah, and you brought up cycling, and the guest that we're going to have on today that you actually interviewed yourself while I was wandering around out in the high desert.
With lightning.
Yeah, with lightning and metal poles. Colin Reuter.
Reuter.
Went out on a bit of a limb and put together some really solid data for what he felt was someone cheating in a race that he was recently in, right?
Yeah. Colin is a local guy here to New England. As we talk about on my interview with him, he runs something called crossresults.com. If you've ever done a cross race in the United States, or probably the world, it's likely that you are on Colin's crossresults.com website. And I was around, I mean, I wasn't with him, but I remember it for starting. And basically what he does is as he says, we crunch data so you don't have to. He gets results. He has an algorithm in place, which then gives you a score for your results, for your placing, that then ranks you against all other cyclocross competitors in the world. And, you know, more specifically for purposes of competitors and race directors locally, where do you fit in the ranking of people you compete against? And so Colin was doing this race called the 24 Hours of Great Glen. It's a mountain bike race up in New Hampshire. And he tells an interesting story on his blog about his speculation and then accusation that one competitor in this race, 24-hour race, they was competing on a team, broke the rules. Mm. And not just broke the rules, you know, out of, you know, benign negligence, but broke the rules intentionally. And Colin's claim is that this person went out and, quote-unquote, cheated. And Colin went through what I would call extensive data analysis, what others might not, depending upon where you come down on this thing, of this person's results, not only at that race, but this person's internet footprint of results, be it on Strava or at the USA Cycling results page or wherever, and to see, is it possible that this person's seemingly divergent results were in fact legitimate and valid? Mm-hmm. And as I talk about with Colin, Colin thinks no, that this person did in fact cheat, not the first time this person cheated, and it kind of erupted into this big internet thing on his website, until the snowends.blogspot.com, where a lot of people were starting to hurl insults and accusations, and it got a little testy. So we thought it would be a good idea to interview Colin about the process of coming to terms with this accusation and then his decision to come out with it and his blog and then what ensued after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was fascinated reading through. I mean, there was, I don't know, like 150 comments or something like that, and I read through all of them. And, you know, at first I was a little bit skeptical, like, gosh, you know, that's pretty ballsy calling some guy out about cheating. I mean, what if this guy is actually that fast? And, you know, what it could boil down to is he rode a couple of laps of this 24-hour race extremely fast, like faster than most pros in the world could ride it. And yet and then he would like compare that to his normal lap times or his previous results from other races and things like that. And it's like, could he even do this? It'd be like you run a, you know, maybe a 4:30 marathon consistently for 5 years, and then all of a sudden you run a 3:30 marathon, and it's
right.
Like, what's going on here? You know, so that's kind of where it came from, and he put a lot of time and effort into it, man. But the guy, like you said, he puts on crossresults.com, and so he's used to the data crunching, and he's used to seeing, I think, patterns of certain racers. I'll bet you could ask him, you know, someone who races in New England, what would his average speed be on a course, on this particular course? And I bet he could tell you. You know, just he's used to seeing these things. So that's why it was kind of called into question when he saw the anomaly. And someone else actually in the comments, who is another data cruncher, God love him, because I'm not one of them. But anyway, he put together a chart with average daytime lap times and nighttime lap times. And then he showed this guy who Colin calls out where he placed, and he was definitely an outlier by far,
right,
from everybody else. So it's, you know, is it conclusive? I don't know, but it's very persuasive.
It's compelling.
Yeah,
it's very compelling to see, and it's also, you know, as in the absence of any body, I mean, not person, but any governing body, then you end up with people self-policing. You know, the absence of government is not anarchy, right? The absence of government is whatever order emerges. And this idea that people are starting to self-police, and as we saw with Brandon, as we saw with Colin, and the reaction that generates, right? The reaction that generates, not that people, some people are very thankful and appreciative, and other people question, why would you rat somebody else out, especially when you have no quote-unquote hard facts or hard evidence, I should say, of the infraction.
Yeah. And just to make it clear, these are two, you know, comparisons between Rob Krar and this other guy at this cyclocross race, or this mountain bike race, completely different contrast. I mean, obviously, I want to just make it very clear that we are not saying that Rob intentionally ran a longer course. That would be stupid.
And that was part of the reason why people looked at Rob and said he might have violated the letter of the law, but he did not violate the spirit of the law.
Exactly. He gained no advantage by doing this, where this other guy, you know, got a clear advantage by cutting several minutes off his race.
Right.
Times. So just to make that clear, so no one comes chasing after us. So anyway, let's just get into you speaking with Colin then.
Okay, here we go.
David, without Tim Long. Tim Long is currently out in the deserts around Grand Junction, placing around 500 stakes into the ground, marking off the course for the Grand Junction Epic Mountain Bike Race, which will be taking place this weekend. So Tim couldn't join us for this part of the show. I do have Colin Reuter on the phone or on the podcast. Colin is well known to people around New England and now around the United States, if not internationally, for crossresults.com. Colin is a purveyor of all things data relating to cyclocross racing, where he developed a website where you can rank participants by virtue of their race results. And this is really helpful to race promoters like me and like Colin to provide staging for participants, where before participants would just run to the front and it was by luck of the draw whether or not they were lined up in front or in the back. Colin helped to provide some kind of structure, some kind of organization to how we view cyclocross racing, staging, and results, and how we compare ourselves to one another. And one of Colin's most recent exploits, along with cyclocross results, is also at his blog, untilthesnowends.blogspot.com, where he talked about an event he just took part in called the 24 Hours of Great Glen. And during this race, participants can either race by themselves or part of a team, and within the larger race across teams and individuals, there's a race within the race of who does the fastest laps during the daytime and at the nighttime. And Colin, in his data analytic way, came across a rather puzzling series of results involving a particular participant who we will call Sam for this podcast. Colin, tell us about the race a little bit and how you came to be associated with the 24 Hours of Great Glen.
Sure. So, you know, 24-hour racing is, you see, like you said, it's either team or individual. An individual is horrible, so we don't even talk about that. But if you're on a team, it's four guys, and you take turns riding the course as fast as you can, basically, for 24 hours. And the course itself is about 45 minutes. So you're getting in, let's say, 8 or 9 laps over the course of 24 hours if you're going fast. And, you know, every lap gets a lap time, and it's all recorded. And the results service that at this race actually is really good. These guys, Granny Gear. So all the data from every lap that gets ridden, it ends up being like 20,000 miles of bike riding or something. That all gets put up both during the race and stays online afterward. So one of the interesting things about Great Glen is that there's a huge disparity in rider ability. You got your token pros some years, or like your local superstars, all the way down to like really casual cyclists who are, you know, this is probably the only race they do. And it's hard for the, it's hard to even call it a race, even though they're doing it. You know, it's just a, to them, it's just an adventure where you ride your bike for 24 hours with your friends. So there's a lot going on at the same time. You've also got all these solo riders progressively becoming zombies throughout the course of the race. But one of the races within the race that people pay attention to, at least if you're on the fast end, is the fastest lap prize. And this year, I very briefly held the title of fastest lap before getting knocked off. But
and, so, and there's fastest laps for daytime and nighttime, right?
Right. Yep. So yeah, there's fastest day lap and fastest night lap. Because you know, because riding at night is actually really unique to the event. You know, most mountain bike races happen during the day, so that's pretty cool. But you know, the true fastest lap always comes in the day, right? You can't ride faster in the dark than you can during the day, especially because riding in the dark starts when you're already fatigued.
Right.
So, you know, your first chance to even set fastest night lap comes at 8 p.m. So by then you've been racing for 8 hours. So no matter, you know, you've probably done at least 3 laps.
And how technical? I mean, talking about technical, not just tourney, but Rudy and Rocky, for those not familiar with New England mountain bike racing, there can be a lot of roots, a lot of rocks, and can be pretty tight and twisty.
Right. Yeah, this course is actually, overall, it's relatively easy as far as New England mountain biking goes. It's like it's a lot of fast double track interspersed with some technical trails. So, you know, there's stuff that would kill you to ride at night in New England, and then there's this. Like, right. This is pretty easy, which is nice. So, you know, the reason we're here is that we're looking at fastest lap, because fastest lap is just one of the many things you look at during your 24-hour race when you're killing time in between racing. And the way it'll go usually goes is that, like, fastest lap gets set right away, you know, because everyone's, like, we're all racing bikes, everyone's fatiguing. So the fastest lap you're ever going to do is going to be your first or maybe your second, because sometimes on your second lap, you're still fresh enough to go faster, and, like, maybe you're not caught in traffic, or maybe you make fewer mistakes. Like, my second lap this year was only 3 seconds worse than my first lap. Okay. And then it just gets slower from there. So, you know, the race progresses, you know, fastest lap gets established real early. It was this guy, Don, who did, like, a 39.50, and that's that. You know, so then we race bikes 24 hours and get totally destroyed. And then in the morning, all of a sudden, the fast lap changes. And it's this dude named Sam who clocks a 36.54. So that's 3 minutes faster than the time Don did, which is literally 10% faster.
And we should say that Don is, I know who Don is, and right. Don is really, really fast.
Right, he's super fast. I mean, he's not a pro.
Right.
And to be, you know, he is 50. So he's, the fact, yeah, the concept of someone beating Don by 3 minutes is not impossible. It's just unlikely. So, and, you know, then the fact that he did it in the morning was, like, even more interesting. Because, like I said, every single person in the race, except this guy, Sam, does their fastest lap in the first afternoon when they're fresh. Right. So what happened was after the race, you're totally cracked. Like, you're, you know, stuff happens and you're like, you're barely awake.
Right.
But then Monday you get some sleep and we're like, man, who is this dude that went so good? Cause you know, usually when people are that good, like 10% better than everyone else at a race, there's some kind of, you know, they have some kind of internet profile.
Right.
But the old Google was really not very, lucrative on this guy. He had done some races like 3 years ago that were totally mediocre. He had like no results for the past couple years. So it was kind of just weird. It was like, so you got to figure he's like some kind of prodigy biker type, you know, like dude doesn't really care about racing, but just happens to be crazy gifted.
Right.
So like that was the initial conclusion we came to. And I remember that like some of the other guys at the race were fairly skeptical of his time. But I thought they were just being typical, like kind of like semi-fast whiner types where they're like, oh, I'm so good. Like no one could be that much better than me. But, you know, I had done Great Glen 3 years ago when Justin Lundin showed up and he put 3 to 4 minutes a lap into me for the whole race. So like, to me, it was very conceivable that a, you know, national level cyclist could go this much faster than the local fast guys.
And for those who might not know, Justin Lundin, I believe, still races for Redline. Mm-hmm. And he is both a pro mountain biker and a pro in cyclocross, has raced down in South Africa and has also raced, I believe he's raced in China as well, yep, last year in a mountain bike stage races. So to say Justin Lundin is 3 to 4 minutes faster than you is saying quite a lot about how fast you are, but it's also saying how fast Justin Lundin is than everyone else.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's been top 15 at mountain bike nationals and cross nationals. Right. So, you know, he's one, we'll call him one of the top 20 guys at pedaling a bike in the country.
Right.
So, you know, for a guy I've never heard of to be going roughly as fast as Justin is, you know, pretty remarkable. And maybe worthy of a little research. Like, I thought it was cool initially that, you know, dudes are that fast, but you never heard of them. I was also, of course, totally jealous because I want to be that fast and I'm not. But so, you know, so we dabbled around on the internet a little bit. Never really, but like there was nothing on this guy. You know, he exists on Strava, but he barely rides there. Like that doesn't prove anything. So it's kind of just like a big like void. He was like a mystery. It was only when I found him on the 2010 Great Glen results that it all fell into place. So 2010 is actually the year that Lundin smashed me and smashed my team at Great Glen. And that's when I found out how fast Justin was. And while Justin was smashing my team, this one guy named Sam Anderson was doing better laps than Justin on the second morning of the race. And how this escaped me at the time, I don't really know, except that when there's 400 people in a bike race, it's hard to look at everyone's laps. But to me, like the moment that, you know, I like threw my headphones across the room and was like, wait a minute, was, you know, it's 9 a.m. on this, you know, the second morning. So we're 21 hours into the race and Justin goes out and rides a 37 in a lap. My lap at this time was like a 41 or a 42. Meanwhile, this dude, Sam, goes out and rides a 36 minute lap, beating Justin by a minute. And then it turns out that's not even, he's not even done there, because that's the first of two laps back to back he's about to ride. And then his second lap is like a 38. So all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute. This guy went head to head with probably the fastest dude to show up at Great Glen in the last 5 years. And he beat him by a minute, and then he did another lap. So now he's at like the Todd Wells level of mountain bike racing. Todd Wells, of course, being the current national champion, or certainly multi-time past national champion.
Right.
So that's really fishy. And of course, the other thing that jumps out is when you look at his lap times for the 2010 race, they start out at 45. It's like a 45 and then a 42. And then the sun goes down and he's doing like back-to-back 39s. And then the sun comes up and he does like a 36 and then a 38 on a back-to-back. And this is these numbers just like, you know, if you've done enough 24-hour racing, you know that the idea of like negative splitting by 6 minutes in the morning relative to your previous afternoon time is basically impossible unless you were mechanicaling. If you were flatting, breaking chains, like that's the only explanation for how you could be so fast on day two but so slow on day one.
Right. And so what's interesting about this, and by again, going back to your blog, until the snow ends.blogspot.com, where you lay all this out, is perhaps even more interesting or alarming or disconcerting than the story you're telling here about your analysis are the number of comments that were generated during that same time. The first blog has 188 comments. And part two, because there always needs to be a sequel to a good first edition story, 34 comments. And the comments are really interesting because on the one hand, you have people who are, you know, very, you know, irritated about this issue. Then you have people, the defenders, who are at the same time saying, you know, well, it's possible. And what I find interesting about this whole thing is as we talked about beforehand, what constitutes evidence? You know, your evidence is essentially that you did this analysis, your experience and this data analysis, which is not that different, by the way, in terms of its spirit than what professional cycling people do to try to find cheaters is by looking at things like watts per kilogram or VAM or any other kind of numeric means, blood passport, look at values, because it's really hard to find someone, catch someone, quote unquote, red-handed. And
right.
So data stands in for this kind of audit to identify what people are doing wrong or if they're cheating. And you caught a lot of heat on the comments section, I'm guessing, in your inbox.
No, well, the inbox was actually really a really safe place because people that had beef wanted to put it out there where other people could see it. So I actually didn't get anything in my inbox except some encouragement. But yeah, so it was, you know, there's even more evidence that I didn't go into, thank God. But yeah, I mean, he was effectively guilty by data. Because it's, you know, when you're cutting the course primarily at night, you know, you've got a giant light on your head that lets people know where you are. So if your strategy is to cut the course, you know, and people, if anyone's ever going to see you, you'll see their light. So you just don't cut the course at that time. And this course has like a couple different places you can cut it. So he had pretty good options there. But yeah, so one of the interesting thing to me was the people that would be when they see all this data, you know, I think there was probably 6 or 8 laps over 3 years of racing that were totally fishy. So if you had experience racing a team 24-hour race at a serious level, you know, there was 6 or 8 laps that were just totable. But the number of people that didn't consider that to be proof and thought like this was inappropriate because it was just conjecture, that really surprised me. And I didn't know what to say about that. Because it's, you know, it's like having a hematocrit of 60 or climbing a mountain in the tour at 7 watts per kilo. Like, these are just numbers that you can't do unless you're cheating.
Right. And, you know, if we take one of my favorite movies is 12 Angry Men. The original, not the remake, about Henry Fonda, about the courtroom discussion about whether someone killed someone or not. And my point there is, what constitutes reasonable doubt, right? I mean, so if we have this standard of beyond all reasonable doubt, well, one of the tricky things in a courtroom or a court of law is, what's reasonable doubt?
Right.
And on the comments section, there are those who are saying, this is beyond reasonable doubt. It's clear. No one's putting in lap times close to Justin Lundin, who has no record of performance up to that point at that level. It's just not possible, number one. Number two, it's not possible that you're turning in faster lap times at night into a 24-hour mountain bike race. That's not possible.
Right. The whole correlation of really fast lap times only happening at times of day when it was hard to catch someone cheating.
Right.
Then that was the crux of the issue. So both at night and in the morning, when the course is really spread out and getting lonely, you know, like, so the fact that over 3 years he'd never put in a legitimately fast lap early in the race,
right?
Like, that was really the crux of the argument. And you know, to me, it was very clearly beyond reasonable doubt. Like, I'm not going to write a blog post, you know, sullying this poor dude's reputation if I think he's kind of guilty. And I mean, I left the post basically at the end. I mean, the out was, show me any result that suggests you're capable of this athletic achievement over the past, you know, whatever years. And of course, that evidence doesn't exist, which, you know, confirms guilt. So I feel like it's one of those things where the burden of proof moved to the defendant to prove himself innocent in that case.
Right. And that becomes interesting. I was just looking up his results from this year, and also what's kind of interesting is that the class this person was participating in was the Cruiser Fun class.
Right.
Where it's, again, it's kind of interesting. Again, putting it together, right, what constitutes evidence that if this person is really, 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 really good, and I think if you're as fast as Justin, it constitutes that many reallys, then how in the world are you racing that fast? And also the variance within the laps, right, that you have. I mean, if we were going to do like a, you know, analysis of variance kind of thing.
Yeah.
What is the range that would be acceptable without it being significant?
Right. Right. And one of the problems with this approach in 2014 was he only rode 4 laps in the whole race. in 2014 because, like you said, he was on that cruiser team. And cruiser teams are supposed to be just for fun. And, like, you know, nothing wrong with having a cruiser team that's a motley crew of people that might ride very casually, and then, like, someone might have a friend that's super fast, you know? I'm not saying, like, oh, he shouldn't be fast if he's on a cruiser team. But it did, like, definitely complicate the picture a lot because it's hard to really get a profile of someone's riding ability when all they do is four laps. And that's why, to me, I thought he was definitely – he was innocent in off his 2014 data. It was only when his 2010 and 2011 data came out that was so incredibly fishy that then the logical extrapolation of that is, well, if he cheated in 2010 and he cheated in 2011, then he probably cheated in 2014 as well.
And so that, one of the other things that came up a lot on your blog comments is, why bother? Why spend this much time trying? And you did spend a lot of time. If people go to your blog and they read it, they'll see the amount of detail you go into. Arthur Anderson wishes they did this complete of a job with Enron, right? I mean, it's pretty,
right.
It's pretty complete. Why spend this much time going into it?
There's two reasons. I guess, I mean, first of all, because it's interesting if you like data, and it, you know, and it's also exposing someone cheating at, you know, the sport I love. Like, I'm not a professional bike racer. I don't get paid to do this, but, like, this is, like, my primary hobby, you know. This is what I do on my weekends. So it's bike racing is as important to me as it is to probably most guys that get paid to do it. So, you know, when someone cheats at a bike race I was in, you know, it's a bit of a, like, it's I'm personally offended because, like, this is my community. This is my life. Like, you know, I don't want cheaters in my community. I don't think anybody would want cheaters in their community. The other reason that I was so thorough about it was that if you're going to call a guy a cheater on the internet, then you want it to be the strongest case you can make, and you want it to be a totally fair analysis. You know, like, if you're going to basically bury a guy's racing career on the internet, then you owe him the respect of doing it, like, thoroughly and completely. So there's not, you know, it's a situation where you don't want to be trying to let, like, your words convince people. You want to just have the data be there. So that in 5 years, if anyone's ever trying to figure out if it was legit or not, they can look at the data, they can draw their own conclusions fundamentally.
Right. And, you know, you're a well-known person around New England. You put on 3 bike races, one of which is the week after my bike race, as well as other well-known bike races, and you work for an industry leader in race registration. Was there any concern about going with this and any repercussions you might have or people's reaction?
I think this is where my naivety helped, in that it never even occurred to me. To me, it was like, this is a fact that I have concluded and it should be shared with the world. And I guess the side effects of doing it did not weigh very heavily on me. Based on some of the phone calls and emails I got, I probably should have thought about it a little more, but I still think it was the right thing to do. One of the questions that seemed to come up a lot was people would say, well, why didn't you just go to the promoter with this information? And the answer to me is pretty clear that, you know, going to, like, the promoter has no incentive to out a cheater. You know, and I don't mean this to try to, like, speak poorly of the Great Glen promoter, who are actually really good people. And they directly contacted me, and I turned over what evidence I had to them. But, I mean, the promoter has no incentive to spread the word about someone cheating at their event. But it's the type of thing where the internet is really good at it. And to me, like, if a guy's been cheating for 3 years straight, my rationale was that that's 3 strikes and you should be out at that point. So I felt like the world needed to know, and that's why I put it out there.
And is this race sanctioned by USA Cycling or by any governing body?
It's not. This is, you know, there's no organizing body. It's just a bunch of people in the woods doing stuff at a venue. So it's not like this would ban him from future USA Cycling events or anything.
The reason why I ask is because, you know, there's probably no officials there governing over the race. And so the you know, that puts the responsibility back on the race director, race promoter,
right.
which
right.
is a really uncomfortable place to be.
Right. Yeah. There is definitely not a neutral third party in enforcing the rules. You know, the promoter is effectively the dictator, which does put some stress on them because, you know, they're trying to make their customers happy, and the cheater and his friends are still their customers.
Right.
And they can't pass the buck to an official.
And so, and it does say, I'm looking at their website right now because they do have rules posted. Shortcutting on the course shall result in immediate disqualification of that racer's entire team. And it becomes a question of, and short of someone seeing you do it, so short of someone seeing you intentionally cut a course, and it's a long course, I don't think it's possible to have volunteers stationed at every intersection for 24 hours. And I don't know if they have course tape out or what kind
of... The course was aggressively marked. And this is actually, I think, because last year there was another very bogus fastest lap time turned in. But last year there was also some issues with course markings getting knocked down or something. So it was more plausible that a wrong turn happened. So the course was marked to death this year. There was basically snow fence across every single intersection. But, you know, you can go around and under snow fence. We're in the woods. It's an 8-mile course. It's not like you can do a full snow fence enclosure.
Right.
And likewise, you know, we're trying to keep entry fees down, and running an event is hard. You know that.
Yep.
You know, the feasibility of getting a volunteer to marshal every potential shortcut spot for 24 hours is ridiculous. You know, it'd be one thing if this was like 24-hour nationals, and you had a big budget, and we're like, we care about cheating a lot, but you know, this you shouldn't have to do that.
And you have a kind of an interesting relationship with rules at events. And you do. And I'm thinking here of firsthand knowledge of your race, Ice Weasels.
Mm-hmm.
And having been there at the – and you'll see where I'm going with this in a second. Having been there the first year you had this Ice Weasels race, which is in December. It was run at the same time originally as USA Cyclocross Nationals and was meant to be kind of this fun way of finishing off the year for the cyclocross community here in New England. And we violated a lot of rules at that race.
We did, but none of them benefited the person violating the rules, unless you consider drinking beer to be a benefit.
I was just going to explain that some of the rules we would violate is that one of the rules in cyclocross is there are no hand-ups allowed of any food or drink outside of the pit area, and that's when designated by the official that it's hot enough where feeds are warranted. Beer feeds are definitely not allowed ever, nor is it allowed to drink out of the flamingo. I believe,
right,
or cupcake or food hand-ups. But we nevertheless did these things because it was kind of a fun atmosphere. And yet at a certain point, it was interesting because the officials that we know were put in a kind of difficult position of having to kind of either look the other way or have to enforce the rules. And it seemed like it came down to mutual agreement that we're just not going to have this thing officially sanctioned.
Yeah, so what happened there was, right, we were putting, you know, the officials are in charge of seeing that the event meets USA Cycling standards. And the reason it needs to meet USA Cycling standards, one of those reasons is insurance. So asking the officials to endorse what was basically becoming a drunken bike race,
right,
you know, was exposing them to liability or at least trouble with USA Cycling. And, you know, they would crack down or they would get in trouble from above. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, any event, any drunken bike race will inevitably have 500 photos of it on the internet. You know, so when you've got photos of kids who may or may not even be 21 drinking beer out of a flamingo
right.
during the bike race, I don't think that played very well at USA Cycling headquarters when it was, you know, time to talk about the season and how things went. So with weed, it was one of those things where I didn't think it was fair for them to keep having to insure our shenanigans, and they agreed. So we stopped doing it as a sanctioned race 2 years ago. So now the liability is entirely on me and my co-promoters, and it's the price we have to pay to keep it what it is, and so be it. And I would like to point out, though,
yes, Gary, For the record.
Once in the history of Ice Weasels, which has happened 6 or 7 times now, I can't remember, one person has been DQ'd by me personally and is the only person to ever cut the course in the bike race.
How they cut – which venue was this?
This was at the old venue in Wrentham.
Where would you cut the course at that
venue? So this is the thing. There was a little loop around the bushes, and there was a section that was taped, and then there was a section of kind of like tall grass that wasn't taped. And, you know, 500 riders were able to determine that the tall grass that wasn't taped was not a valid cut-through. You had to ride the extra 30 feet around this like group of trees,
right?
But one junior thought he was really clever, and would just cut between the tape. He could cut between the tape and like the trees by riding through like the deep grass. And he did it a couple times, and the guys he was racing with complained, and he finished in the money, so we DQ'd him.
And so. I think a lot of this. I when I recently won the Cat 3 Massachusetts State Championship, which you may have been familiar with.
I do remember your glorious victory,
right? I was in front of a guy, because I passed him early in lap one, and then I passed him again at the end of lap one.
That's pretty shady.
And I said to him, I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said to me, "What are you doing here?" And it was clear that he missed a turn, right?
Or you had missed a turn. No, bonus distance.
Because I pre-rode the course, and I knew that there was this one section where if he didn't look, there was mm-hmm. a sharp left turn coming mm-hmm. out of the woods, and it was easy to miss. So he must have missed it there. And he, you know, we talked briefly on the bike about it as we're racing coming into the finish of lap one, and he felt really bad about it.
Yep.
He did not DQ himself. We were so far ahead, me, him, and another guy, so far ahead of everyone else, that it probably didn't materially impact where he finished in the race. It might have, though. He did not DQ himself, and I did not go to the officials and say, this guy, you know, did not ride the entire course lap one. Because mm-hmm. it was clear to me he didn't mean to do it. So did I handle that properly, or do you think I should have gone to the officials or encouraged him to go confess and DQ himself?
That is an interesting ethical dilemma. Because you were in a fortunate position in that his cheating didn't rob you of anything because you beat him anyway.
Right.
But it probably robbed someone of something, although it's hard to say.
And I think this characterizing as cheating – I think if we talk about is cheating, well, does that convey intent?
It's true. Cheating does convey intent. So his not following of the rules, assuming the rules are you must stay on the course. We can agree he didn't follow the
right.
rules. So he did gain some benefit from not following the rules. Then again, we're talking about a Cat 3, which is the lowest category.
No.
Also, I just want to emphasize that to listeners that you did win the lowest category.
I was the fastest Cat 3 on that day.
You were definitely the best
out of all the age groups.
Well, that's how sandbagging works.
Yes.
But that's
how it works.
That issue aside, so you know this guy's course cutting may not have gained even a single place in the results. You know, depending on how much course he cut and how many times he did it. We'll assume he only did it once because it was an accident, right? So. You know, it's a total gray area. If I was him in his position, I would have DQ'd myself. I have DQ'd myself before from races, but that's something that kind of comes with experience, and experience is not what Cat 3s are known for. So I give all of you a pass on this scandal, except you, because you should upgrade.
Right, and I did upgrade, but you know, it really raises this interesting question again, because you raise this issue about the community, and you're really talking about, in some ways, rules, and in some ways, norms. And I technically followed the rules of USA Cycling in terms of categories. I was a novice mountain biker, right? And mm-hmm. the criteria for upgrading to Cat 2 is basically if you feel like you should be a Cat 2, then you can upgrade. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically what the USA Cycling rules say. And when I went to the officials after the race and I said, I need to upgrade, the official actually told me, oh, you don't need to upgrade. It's okay. Even though you won, you don't need to upgrade.
Right.
So technically, I was following the rule, but there was much discussion. Some of it was kind of surprisingly angry that I violated the norms, that I violated some ethos
right.
of the community.
And that brings up like a very interesting point in that the officials and the community are actually very different things. They don't interact as much as you'd want them to. You know, the officials don't have a great handle on how the community feels about things. But, you know, I would say that because in mountain bike racing you can choose to start in Cat 2 or Cat 3, a guy with your fitness, I mean, after all, you are basically an elite athlete when it comes to running. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Not quite, but I get your point. That's right. Definitely better than average.
Right. And Grant, you know, running is very different from mountain bike racing, but it could be reasonably assumed. And you race cyclocross and you've raced road bikes too, right?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's not mountain biking, right? I mean, these are very different disciplines.
Right. So, you know,
I get your point.
Had you consulted with a community member like myself, they probably would have told you that you should race the Cat 2 race. But at the same time, racing the Cat 3 race when you don't know any better is a forgivable offense. You know, anyone that you beat who was offended by your sandbagging, which is not me, by the way. Let's note that when I'm heckling you about this, I don't really care.
Right.
None of those people should be especially upset with you. I mean, this is a common occurrence. Someone does their first mountain bike race and has no idea how overqualified they are for Cat 3. It happens like all season long in every race. So none of them really have a legit beef. And, you know, now that you understand more of the community expectations of your categorization, you're a Cat 2, everything's fine.
Right.
We move on. This role will repeat itself next year with, you know, a triathlete or an 18-year-old or whatever.
And it does raise this, you know, this issue again of how communities self-police enforcing
right.
norms. Again, I'm a sociologist, so this is how I think and talk. They enforce norms, right, that mm-hmm. are not written down. They're
right.
tacit, not explicit. And this brings us full circle back. On the age of the internet, we see a lot more of that taking place through vehicles such as Facebook, Twitter,
exactly.
Strava,
right.
blogs, even, I guess, Snapchat, right, where people are doing these things.
I can't say I've ever Snapchatted anyone about upgrading, but I'll consider it. I'm not quite sure how I would do that.
You take a picture of a sandbag.
Oh.
And then you would type in a message, you know, that was kind of a snide comment.
That's a great
idea.
Which
you're very
actually.
Good at, right?
Yeah, actually, I should have. Yeah, okay. So you got hassled by your friends who are members of the community on the internet, and, you know, that's how business was taken care of. And that does happen more and more now. You know, for better or for worse, whenever you take actions in the world, they can always potentially be discussed on the internet, and it's not something you can opt out of.
And so if someone was going to defend Colin's actions on the internet of why did Colin do this, a big part of it has to be, or at least from the basis of our conversation, in the absence of official action by either race officials or the organizers, either because the race officials aren't even there or there's a disconnect, or the organizer that they're in an uncomfortable position to enforce such action, in absence of that, then it's up to the community members to self-police and enforce its both the rules as they're written out and the norms. So it's not only that
right.
you violated a rule, but that, you know what, we don't do that here. This is not how we conduct business. This is not how things are done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, ultimately the sport should be run by the community, more or less. You know, and the more grassroots something is, the more it is run by the community. You know, it's like the NBA might not be run by the community, but ultra running probably is more run by the community because it's people doing it more for fun and less for money. So there's less expectation of someone else running the show and you just being a passive participant in it.
Right.
You know, so like the community cares way more than the officials or any sanctioning body would because, you know, we do it for love, not for money.
And the idea that in events that are endurance events, whether mountain bike or running, or skiing, right? Because you are very proficient at cross-country skiing.
Used to be.
Which I need to ask you about that because I have a bad idea about doing a 50K this coming winter. The idea that a race of that magnitude can't be policed by officials all the time and that they need to be policed or enforced by members of the community. And I should let you know that one of my friends who's out in Colorado, he identified a possible violation or an actual violation by an elite ultra runner by using Strava.
Really?
Yeah. Brandon Fuller, who we will talk about with Tim Long when he's on, he identified this thing, and it kind of blew up a little bit on the internet, whether or not Rob Carrar, who won the Leadville 100, he left the course but came back on, adding distance over a very short distance, but nevertheless left the course and didn't re-enter it at the point that he left it. And this result, this technically is a violation of the rules and should result in a disqualification, but the Leadville 100 race officials, race directors came out and said that because there was no material advantage as a result of that, and it was not intentional, it was due to what they called inadequate course markings, that his win was let stand.
I think that's the right call.
I think it's the right call too, and we'll get into that. I'll get into that with Tim Long about it. And I should also mention that you have your own race coming up, which is called Night Weasels Cometh. And that's, again, the week after my race. And
It's the original Night Cyclocross race, not like this knockoff Midnight Ride.
I will admit, it's a total knockoff. And I thought, well, hell, if Colin can do it.
It can't be that hard, right?
It can't be that hard. Anybody can do it. And I said, hell, my place, you know, is actually set up for, you know, a nice cross race. It's not a ski hill, so
exactly. It
can't be that bad.
I mean, for the record, I love your race because it gives me a chance to actually do a race at night instead of just promote a race at night.
I race my race. I do the last race of the night, and which is suicidal after promoting it. But it's a lot of fun. But Colin has more people sign up for his race than mine. It's okay. I'm okay with that. And Colin also does Narweasels, which is a mountain bike race. So when Colin talks about race promoter stuff, he's speaking about it as a race promoter. When he talks about participant stuff, he participates. And when he talks about it from a data perspective, Colin knows data. I think if it's safe to say anything, Colin knows data.
It's true.
So what's next for you?
What's next?
Besides pulling people down on the internet.
Hopefully not doing that for a while. Hopefully never again will that have to happen. What's next for me is trying to get enough in shape that I can finish Gloucester in a month.
Grand Prix of Gloucester, yeah.
Right. And then try to survive promoting Night Weasels.
Amen to that. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Sorry Tim couldn't be here, but right now he's probably trying to find water in some canyon out there in Grand Junction as he sets up the bike race that I was going to do originally, but it just didn't work out that I could head out to Colorado. So I'm going to do Landmine 50 instead. I'm furthering my foray into mountain bike endurance events after my not-so-stellar performance at Burlingame, which was hard.
That was a long time ago, though.
It was really hard.
What category did you register for?
There's only one category, I believe.
Makes it easy.
Hey, you know what, though? And that's running, right? I mean, you mountain bikers and cyclists, you have all these separate categories based on age and classification. And running, and in triathlon, it's just the same age group. And
exactly.
You deal with what you're dealt, and that's it. And then there's no complaints from anybody over anything. And it makes life much simpler. But that's another podcast for another time. Colin, thanks for coming on the show, and we appreciate your internet sleuthing, and anybody wants to see that, you can go to untilthesnowends.blogspot.com. If you want to check out Colin's race, just search for Night Weasels Cometh, and you can find it on the internet in all of its glory and all of its photos. And you'll have – is DJ Jeremy going to be there again this year?
We are working on securing DJ Jeremy Powers for the 2014 event. But I'm sure that his presence in 2013 is the reason that my pre-registration is running ahead of yours.
You will always kill me in pre-reg. I ain't mad. And for those who don't know, Jeremy Powers is the current U.S. champion in cyclocross. So having DJ Jeremy or whatever he goes by, Jazzy Jeremy.
DJ J-Pow, I believe.
DJ J-Pow just kind of rolls off the tongue.
I just made that up right now.
Right. So. There you go. Well, thanks a lot, Colin. I appreciate your time.
Anytime, Gary.
Well, that was quite interesting, and thanks to Colin for, you know, talking with you. It opened up a lot of cans of worms, I guess.
There's a lot of issues to be explored regarding, you know, how the community evaluates its own norms, how officials evaluate violations of the rules, whether or not we need more rules, whether or not you can write a rule to satisfy every potential outcome, and let me assure you, you can't. And what do we do then? Does it mean since we can't, presuppose or have an idea of what every violation is going to be, should my syllabus be 20 pages or 30 pages? Well, look at how long law is. And it seems like every time we write a rule, someone's going to figure out a way to get around it. And so where does that leave us? I'm not sure, but I do know that at the end of it, It's almost like the smell test. If it smells bad, it probably is bad. And if it looks bad, it probably is bad. And with Rob Krar, you could tell that it wasn't intentional. So people, even though it's a violation, are willing to give him a big pass. And with some of these other ones, people look at it and say, that doesn't look like it was accidental. It looks like that person was trying to do it for nefarious reasons. And then people react and say, no, we can't let that pass. And so I think we need to stay in the area where hopefully sound judgment exists. And in the era of the internet and social media, we have this commons that exists out there where people can engage in conversation over what is adequate judgment and what is good justice. And as long as those conversations kind of stay on the let's analyze level and not let's get personal level, I think we're in a good place. But as soon as they start to get personal, then it's really no use in even exploring any further, because nothing beneficial is going to come out of it. No one's mind is going to be changed, and we're not going to be any closer to a resolution.
Yeah. Well, I like the self-policing aspect of, especially like ultra running as it's growing and people kind of have these, standards as a community, I think, for these events. And so it'll be interesting to see where it goes from that into a more official standing, if it does ever. And who knows if it will. But, all I have to say is you better be flipping sure that you're, calling out somebody the right way, I think, like you said, and not make it personal, and you better be certain about your information and proof, because, it could backfire.
And I will say that I have my 50-mile mountain bike race coming up in a few weeks. I have the lawyers back at Elevation Trail headquarters going through the rule book as well as the course map very carefully, identifying areas in which I can gain an advantage so that I can achieve the highest possible place that is owed to me, because it is owed to me. I demand excellence from myself so that other people will recognize how great I am as well. So that's what's going on right now.
Nice.
Going to work the system.
How many officials did you say you have at the cyclocross race, the midnight ride?
Around 4 or 5.
Good Lord.
Yeah, well, when you have a USAC, USA Cycling race, you have officials, right? And you pay for officials. I pay for officials, right? They are paid positions, and we appreciate the officials as a race director, because if something happens, I can say, go talk to the officials, and they're there to help me make sure that the course is safe, the race is run well, so that in terms of insurance and safety and satisfaction of the participants, everything's taken care of. And so we're very fortunate here in New England with the race officials we have. I'm not just saying that because they're going to be at my race soon. Mm. And for me as a race director, it's worth the expense.
Yeah, I agree. But I mean, it's just like any other rules, I think, and laws is, there's a certain like sweet spot where you have just enough to keep some kind of organization going. But if you overdo it, it gets a little bit cumbersome. And takes away some of the fun, I think.
No one wants a big hand of ultra government coming down on them at their next trail run out in the wilderness. They don't want to have to worry about that. But at the same time, when situations like this arise where people are accused of cheating, either unintentionally or intentionally, you kind of like having that there so that they can take care of it.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. All right, well, I think that's a wrap today, and I'm going to go out and cut some courses over the weekend and have fun.
Yeah, I'm going to go out there and ride some on my mountain bike and figure out the most expedient way to cut across woods in order to maximize my lap time and improve my
So you can do the 48-mile, 50-mile race?
You know what? I don't know what happened to my Strava file. It got corrupted. I tried to upload it, and then the damn thing wouldn't work. I swear I had it on there.
Yeah. You can't edit those, can you?
I'm sure as hell going to try.
All right. Well, with that, thanks to you listeners, and please feel free and to give us your comments and your feelings on the whole topic of, having rules at these events, especially ultra running as it grows and evolves over time. We appreciate your listening and your always your insightful comments. And as always, have fun out there on the trails.
down.